There are two ways people have dealt with this pandemic. Some people curled up and turned off, tuned out, played ostrich for a while, lost a bit of momentum on purpose after losing momentum by force. Others, like librettist Matt Borresi and composer Peter Hilliard, took a sharp pivot, stared the pandemic right in the face, and began a creative brainstorm. A few months ago, after a conversation about the relevance of the Decameron, Borresi and Hilliard got in touch with their colleagues Maria Sensi-Selner at Resonance Works and Robert Wood at Urban Arias and put together a massive, ambitious project known as the Decameron Opera Coalition. Today, on this bonus episode of The News You Need, I'm going to chat with Borresi and a few of the librettists who are in the cohort. The Decameron, that famous 14th century collection of novellas by Giovanni Boccaccio, which tells the tales of a group of 10 people sheltering from the Black Plague, speaks to us in a much more poignant fashion these days. Using a similar framing device, Peter Hilliard and Matt Borresi have written a framework that tells the story of a group of friends sheltering in place during the COVID-19 pandemic. The story of each of these friends is told by a different librettist-composer team and commissioned by a different opera company, being filmed in all sorts of ways around the country and then brought together over 4 Fridays in October. The collection is being known as Tales from a Safe Distance, and the 9 world premieres are being written by Rachel J. Peters, Margie Preos, and Jean Schrammack for Lyric Opera of the North in Duluth, Minnesota. Jasmine Barnes and Nikolaus Hochstein Cox for Bear Opera in New York City, Mark Migo and John De Los Santos for Urban Arias in Washington, D.C., Michael Ching and Deborah Brevoort for Fargo-Moorhead Opera in Fargo, North Dakota, Elizabeth Blood and Danny Brilo for Milwaukee Opera Theater in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Donia Girard for Opera in the Heights in Houston, Texas, Maria Thompson Corley and Jenny O'Connell for An Opera Theater in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Gilda Lyons for Resonance Works in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and K.F. Jock for Chicago Fringe Opera in Chicago, Illinois. To tell us more, here is Matt Borresi, along with librettist John De Los Santos, Gilda Lyons, and Deborah Brevoort in an interview from September 26th. So I want to start by introducing everyone I'm speaking with today. First is Matt Borresi, who is the librettist along with composer Peter Hilliard, who has written Tales from a Safe Distance's framing material that surround each individual tale. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
Second is John De Los Santos, who is no stranger to Words First. He's written a piece with composer Mark Migo entitled The Roost, which was commissioned by Urban Arias. Welcome back, John.
Thanks for having me.
Third is Gilda Lyons, who is the composer and librettist for Sourdough Rise Up, commissioned by Resonance Works in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thanks, Keturah.
And last, but not least, is Deborah Brevoort, who is the librettist with composer Michael Ching of Dinner 4-3, commissioned by Fargo-Moorhead Opera. Welcome, Deborah.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So, Matt, I want to start with you. Can you just tell me a little bit about the project? How was the idea sparked and by whom?
Sure. Well, all the way back in March, Peter Hilliard, who's my writing partner, composer Peter Hilliard, we had just completed a production of The Last American Hammer at Pittsburgh Opera, and the world shut down. And yes. He called me quite soon into, yes, you may be familiar with this, quite the lockdown. And he said, have you heard of the Decameron? Or when's the last time you thought of the Decameron? And I hadn't thought about it since undergrad. But he said, you realize that that's about people in lockdown waiting out a plague outside Florence? And I thought, oh, gosh. We thought, boy, that would be great to adapt for opera right now. And it would have, if you said it contemporarily, it would have a lot to say about who we are and where we are and where our relationships are right now.
Right.
At that same time, we were working with Maria Sensi-Selner at Resonance Works, who is producing Gilda's chapter of Tales, Sourdough Rise Up. And we're working on a project with her that's been postponed. But she said late one night, she said, guys, my ears are open. If you have any ideas of how to help let opera not die, please give me a shout. And we said, you know what? Could you zoom with us tomorrow? And we said, you know, Peter had said, because the Decameron is a collection of stories being told by these people waiting out the plague, it seems like it would make for a good anthology. And it would make for a good, rather than us setting 10 chapters of the Decameron, and who would produce that? But if we could get a plurality of voices to set different stories from it, or stories inspired by it, perhaps that is something that could tell a lot of different angles about waiting out a plague. And we talked to Maria, and what we realized about independent companies like Resonance Works is, while some of the large companies were having trouble and are still having trouble pivoting in this new time, that because it's, you know, it's hard to turn the Queen Mary, but independent opera companies are frequently quite visionary, and with having fewer stakeholders are easier to, they can turn more quickly. So we called Maria, and we called Bob Wood at Urban Arias, that's producing John's piece, and we called Sarah Lawrence at Lyric Opera of the North in Duluth, because we'd had wonderful collaborations with them in the past. Mm-hmm. And we said, could we get 10 creative teams together, 9 companies plus Hilliard and Baresi, and each of you would commission a chapter of the Decameron, or inspired by the Decameron, and we'd stream it together so all the companies could raise their profile. And the funny thing about opera is that there's this amazing work being done all over the country, but nobody knows what anybody else is doing. Right. And you frequently don't see anything unless it's produced right by your house. So these companies called other companies that they have had good interactions with. And here we are 6 months later, almost at a world premiere.
Yeah, I think it's just so brilliant. And I also just love, I mean, being someone who's used the pandemic as a chance to talk to people who are actually making opera, I'm just so excited that this brings together so many people using their creative talent. And it is the opportunity for the greater opera community to see what people are writing and doing and producing. And I just think it's brilliant. In terms of your work on this, did the framing of it come first, or did you have to wait to hear everyone else's work before you and Peter could write the interstitial material?
We knew the frame would be a Zoom call of a almost like a, I hate to say this, but like a clip show in a sitcom. Like, sure, all these friends are together having a reunion, the way so many of us have had class reunions and old friend reunions on Zoom. And we know there's Zoom fatigue, so the opera doesn't start in Zoom. We start in a filmic, you know, real world, and then we begin a Zoom call. Mm-hmm. So we knew there would be a Zoom call, and we, as each person caught up with the group, they would tell a story, and then we would go into their chapter. So we knew that would be the framing device, but we did not start to write until all the other pieces were in. So actually, the ink is still wet on the frame. Mm-hmm. Because we wanted to make sure that we could basically pull a character from each piece, right, and have a character from each piece on the ball.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes total sense. I'm going to move over to John now for a second. John, can you tell me a little bit about The Roost? So this is a piece about expecting a baby, yes?
That's correct. And it actually has no connection. The pregnancy part has no connection to the Decameron at all. What happened with me was Bob Wood contacted me in May, asking if I was interested, and I said absolutely. And Matt and had put together some scenarios, just some ideas of things. And I was looking through, and Bob had said, "We really want a comedy," because the whole reason I got the job was because of a piece I did called Service Provider a couple of seasons before that,
yes,
was really
which
funny.
Which we spoke about on this podcast.
Yeah, he wanted something in that vein, and there wasn't really anything that jumped out at me, so I just started reading through the stories, and I found Philostrata's Tale, which is 5-4, and it required a couple, and I was like, well, who do I know that's a couple in quarantine that could do this, and Bob and I had both worked with Sharon Apostolou before, and I said, yeah, she's amazing, so I called her up, and I said, hey, would you and your husband Ryan, even though Ryan has basically retired from singing recently, I said, would you both be interested in doing this? And she said, I would love to, but there's one problem. And I said, what's the problem? And she goes, well, I'm pregnant. And I said, that's not a problem. Let me see if I can incorporate it into the story. Totally. And as I'm sure a lot of the other librettists will tell you, the Decameron is full of a lot of really great female characters, but like a lot of medieval texts written by men, the women are horny for no reason in a lot of the stories.
Sure.
And the story that I chose was definitely like that. The woman is, it's this young girl who is very insatiate, but then I remember talking to my sister and she said, yeah, your hormones go crazy during pregnancy. And yeah, your libido sometimes does go up. And so actually, the pregnancy actually was a great plot point to help explain why the woman is feeling this way at that particular moment. So the pregnancy was just a completely innocuous detail based on our cast that actually made its way into the libretto and made it a lot better.
Well, so this actually, it sort of answers my question. I was reading about Philostrato's tale, and of course it says it's one of the Decameron's sexiest tale. And then when I saw you were writing about an expectant couple, I was wondering if we still got some sexy, but it sounds like we do.
Oh yeah. It's one of my shows. So yeah, there's sexy.
Of course. Fantastic. Moving around the circle here, Gilda, your piece, Sourdough, Rise Up, seems to have a little twist in it that it's got a connection to a graphic novel, or it's presented as a graphic novel. Can you talk to me about that a little?
Yeah. So Maria and I had, we had a long kind of casual relationship. She saw a main stage opera of mine that went up with Opera Theater of Pittsburgh a few years ago. And so we had stayed in touch over the years, and when this project was on deck earlier this summer, she wrote to me and threw out, gave me the framework, told me what this was all about. And so I started going deep into the research, and I just really knew for this project that I was going to write my text. And so because of that, I followed up within a few days of the initial conversation with Maria at, and you had already mentioned Maria, who is with Resonance Works Pittsburgh. And so I said, you know, Maria, since we've talked about the fact that I'm going to be the composer librettist team, what if our creative team actually brings in an illustrator who will help me to tell this story through a graphic novel lens.
Huh.
And what I also love is that Matt spoke about Maria in terms of, this is this wild thing, and Maria's saying, let me know how I can do this, you know, like I'm ready.
Right.
And that's my experience with Maria, is that Maria's ready. And she said the other day, I work until it's done or until I collapse. And that's really true of Maria. And I have respect and admiration, not just for her work ethic, but also for her openness to dive in. Because it's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That idea was like, hey, I know you're used to like the composer librettist team, but what if in this situation, it's a composer librettist illustrator. And so Chris Lyons has done illustrations for this piece that we're really refracting everyday life during COVID through this graphic novel lens and telling a fully illustrated story with where you don't get the live singers on camera. It's all his illustrations.
Oh, how cool. What made you want to use the sourdough starter as your link between friends?
Well, in doing my deep research on the Decameron, I was going through looking at specific stories and trying to think in the, you know, there's just so many that thinking in terms of each one and thinking, you know, that's a tough one. I'm getting that. But what I was really taking away was this through line of everyone wrestling with fortune. And that to me is what I hesitate to speak in those terms because the disparity of how everyone is being affected by all of this is just so vast, right?
Right.
So I would never say, well, we're all doing this, because that's unusual for, there's very few things I can say everybody's doing, but I think everybody is affected.
Yes.
And everybody has to confront their reality now, as opposed to even, you know, a year ago. And so this idea of wrestling with fortune that's integral to the Decameron itself, it's very much where the range of people are now. And these characters that I'm presenting as a sort of superheroes, right? They're not extraordinary in any way other than we're all extraordinary, right? This is everyday life, and these are three friends. And this, I had read early on about a person in Brooklyn who was delivering bread to people and sourdough starter, and that this was a thing. And it had always been in the back of my mind. And for a couple months there, I couldn't buy flour because I was trying not to go to the store because we've got high risk people in our lives that are integral, and so I was trying to only do ordering for as much as I could, and I just couldn't find flour, and I too have a sourdough starter that I started early on, so it was a very natural way in, and it felt like a metaphor that. It was both ordinary and real and kind of got at some things that were meaningful.
Yeah, I love that. Deborah, can you tell me a little bit about what was the Decameron story that inspired Dinner 4-3?
I think that we landed on our story through for very practical reasons. David Hamilton called me and Michael Ching about being part of the project, and then basically handed us a list of ingredients. And the ingredients were that they had three singers that were unemployed in Fargo. They had a soprano, they had a tenor, they had a bassoon player, they had a couple of musicians, and could we find a story that would basically employ their local artists, and those artists sort of became the lens through which we started looking for stories that we could adapt to match those particular talents. I come from the theater, and we call this the bake-off. You just take a set of ingredients and you write from those ingredients. And so that's kind of what we did here. We wrote from the ingredients of the artistic pool in Fargo, North Dakota.
That makes sense.
So then we started reading the story, and we were given a time limit. We were given those ingredients, and then it became which set of stories could these ingredients be put to use for? And when we found day 5, story 10, we had our story because our ingredients were there. So we really went around about this in that way. Mm-hmm. And so Dinner for Three is. As someone mentioned before, the Decameron is, there's a lot of sexual escapades, and it's just, one after another. And, but this is really, what I responded to in this story. This is a story about, a gay man who has a wife, has a trophy wife. So no one will know that he's gay. And obviously there's great unfulfillment in this marriage. And so that felt very contemporary. And we just wrote about this marriage where both partners are on the internet instead of, using the church in medieval times and the local yenta to sort of hook them up. They go online. Now the twist in the story is that, both the husband and the wife have their eye on the same young thing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
and so that's sort of the surprise of the story. And when everyone's cheating is revealed, it's revealed that they're all cheating with the same person, or they're trying to cheat with the same person. And so the husband and wife make an arrangement, and it everyone's needs get fulfilled at the end. Uh-huh. So the piece is it's a truffle. I feel like, it's a little bonbon.
You consider it it's a comedy.
Oh, that was one of our ingredients. It has to be a comedy. So, which was fine with me because Michael Ching loves writing comedy, and I do too. And I was actually, had become very interested in thinking about writing comic opera. And in fact, I'd started taking a class in comic opera this summer with the great Corey Ellison from Santa Fe Opera. And then this, sort of came along, and it had to be a comedy. So it was kind of perfect. So that's how we landed on our story.
Fantastic. So I want to open this up for a bit just to all of you. Just thoughts about working on a project of this scope, which for this is a huge project. Have you been aware of what other writers are working on, or do you feel like you're working in a vacuum of sorts? So what's it been like knowing that you are a piece of this entire puzzle as you write?
This is Matt, and I'll respond first because I've had the privilege and the pleasure of having more of a bird's eye view than some of the folks have gotten. We're all collaborative artists. If we didn't like working with other people, there are far less collaborative fields for a writer to take to enter than writing opera. So we figured that everyone would like some eyeballs on their piece and just a voice, a friendly voice, because there would be no, it would be up to individual companies to decide if there were a dramaturg or, you know, who's sure. looking at the libretti, as they call it. And with a quick turnaround, we knew that there wouldn't be panels and workshops, and you get far less feedback than usual. Right. So writers did send things to Peter and I, and of course to their individual producers and teams as they rolled in. And so for us, I mean, you get to work with a composer when you're a librettist, but as a librettist, I don't get to talk to other librettists very often at all. Mm-hmm. And Deborah was my professor in grad school.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know that I've gotten to talk to her or work with her since, and one of my favorite professors. So to get to be in a conversation, albeit a brief one, with all these people was just joyful.
That's great. Yeah. Anybody else have thoughts about that?
Well, this is Deborah, and hi, Matt, and thank you for that. you know, this happened so fast because we all ordered. Basically, Michael and I turned around this opera in 3 weeks, and because there was delays in getting a copy of the Decameron sent to us, So by the time the book arrived and we did our reading, it was pedal to the metal. So I felt like I had my nose in the computer and Michael had his nose in the score. And all we knew was that there were other teams who were doing this. We didn't have time to think of anybody else. It was sort of like a hope and a prayer. We're going to trust that this is all going to come together. And our producer, Fargo Moorhead, they don't do new work. So David Hamilton, who is the producer of that company, was basically just saying, folks, I'm following you. You tell me what to do. So, I mean, it was like a mad scramble to do it. But it was really fun. We were very much in our own little bubble, kind of like we are in the pandemic. We just were in our bubble.
That's true. Yeah, exactly. It kind of reflects both what you're writing about and just where we are in life right now. Gilda or John, any thoughts you want to share about just what the process has been like?
Well, it's certainly been a highly compressed timeline. And because of that, there wasn't space, as Deborah was just saying, there really wasn't space for us to get to know the larger community of artists that were involved in this. Mm. But that said, the individual meeting with Matt that we had it gave me the direct communication that, oh, there is somebody in charge of that, and that's not my job.
Right.
As somebody who has worn a lot of hats in my life, I really like to know what my job is in a specific context.
Yeah.
And here it was very much about being directly on fire about the work that I was creating, the collaborative work that I was doing with Chris Lyons, the illustrator on the project, and with Maria, who is my music director and the commissioner. And that was my nuclear reactor right there. Mm-hmm. And so I had very early on with Maria, you know, it happened very fast that I pitched this idea of bringing in a graphic, an illustrator, and then turning around a story. I said, what if X, Y, Z? And she said, yeah, I'm feeling that. I'm hearing that. And then, okay, here, it's 3 days later, can we meet? You know, and it was intense, but it was exactly what I needed. Mm-hmm. I loved knowing that all of this was happening elsewhere, but there was really no space for me to be involved in the larger picture, and I knew that wasn't my job because it was delegated.
Yeah, it's nice to be comfortable about that too, right? Like to just know.
Oh, absolutely. I don't need to have my fingers. I don't want to have my fingers in all the things. I was grateful that the people that had commissioned this, and I got to meet with Matt and talk about it. And Maria was part of that core group too. So I knew that they were on it and that they were driving the bus.
How about you, John?
I think I'm a little different because I definitely wanted to know what the other stories were.
Uh-huh.
And I think a lot of that stems, I mean, I wasn't able to because everybody was very insulated and it was a fast turnaround. But I think that because I'm a director also, I wanted to know, like, what is the tone of this? What is the, you know, if I love portmanteau films of the 70s and, you know, they really have to be very specific about how things are placed and, you know, how the ebbs and flows of the narrative goes when you have all these different artists working together. And so I definitely asked around about what are some of the other subjects, because I was just curious. We don't want, you know, 10 sex comedies.
Right.
But yeah, I think that Matt has done a really great job of pairing up the episodes so that there aren't too many that are alike right next to each other. They do have they're thematic, but I think that the flow is going to be really great from episode to episode. So I think it's going to work out really well. But one thing I will say that was really great about this for me was Mark Mego. I had worked with him at Juilliard. He'd never written an opera before. He was a student learning about that. And so when this opportunity came up, I just said, you know, this is a crazy fast project, but, you know, it's a commission and it's going to be seen by a lot of people and it's a high pressure learning experience. So let's just give it a try. And thankfully, I mean, Mark is from Spain, and so he's got this wonderful joie de vivre about everything and a sense of adventure. And so he was really into the project and just really dove in head first. But for his first opera, I think it's really going to be a wonderful little debut for him.
Oh, I love that. That's terrific. And how involved have you been? Have any of you been in the productions themselves? I know they're shooting in various homes, et cetera. I've been looking at a couple of pictures of people putting these things together. What's the involvement like there? Are you on Zoom during these rehearsals? Are you there?
This is Deborah. Michael Ching, the composer for my piece, actually went and conducted the recording session.
Fantastic.
For the music. But we were not involved in the shooting of it, but we did do a lot of pre-production meetings.
Uh-huh.
The director and videographer, I put my libretto, actually, I wrote a screenplay. I put it into a screenplay form.
Oh, okay.
And so it's like a opera libretto meets the screenplay, where I had a lot of different shots. And then we had production meetings, like what kind of shots would be possible. And when they were scouting locations and coming back and saying, well, we can't do this, but we can do that, I was adjusting the libretto and some of the visuals according to what the production folks on the ground could do. Mm-hmm. But it was all done remotely.
Great.
So this is Matt. Here's where I get to be jealous, because our was written and is being filmed individually by all the people in the frame right now. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder for us to be present either physically or via a camera with all the different people who are filming their tracks individually. Now, we did have a rehearsal this morning with a number of the singers and got to do a little table work and answer some questions and have a sense of camaraderie and gather information about tone and so forth. But I've been watching on social media the processes of the other shows, these wonderful socially distanced shooting sets, and it just, oh, it looks so wonderful. For us, we've got everybody trying so nobly to figure out how to film themselves. Now, Kathy Whitman from Ball Square Films is helping direct this frame.
Great.
And helping folks understand how to film themselves and how to record themselves, because this is a heavy lift. For these singers, they're not only learning new work very quickly, they're acting like they're in a Star Wars movie, you know, against a green screen or with people who aren't there in some cases, and placing their own camera and placing their own mic and dealing with the acoustic thing. So it's a big lift for they're being troopers, I'll tell you what. But it's been a very strange process. Of course, Luca Pizzaroni is featured in the frame, and he's all over Europe as he tries to film this and he's got some Italian flavor to bring it back to the source material.
Fantastic.
But I have not been up in the guts of the production process and wish I could be.
Yeah, of course.
I want to give a compliment to all the producers. Well, actually all the artists who took a risk on this crazy thing, because we looked at Peter and I looked at the website realize that there are 86 artists working on this at a time when not everyone is working on anything.
Yeah.
So
that's huge. You know,
that libretto composers would take a risk on this pie in the sky idea and make it happen in 6 months has been a real blessing.
Yeah. John, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say tune in, but also I really hope that once the project has aired, that we can do a Zoom with as many of those artists as possible, because I think it'd be great to have like a little wrap party where all of the composers, librettists, singers, and producers, other artists involved could actually meet each other, have like a little virtual, you know, get together and discuss what we've all seen.
Yeah,
absolutely.
A little cast party for the whole group. That would be great.
I love that idea. I love that idea. Yeah, we should definitely, or maybe we should have an opening night party or something like that.
Yeah, I love that.
Put on our opera clothes and sit in front of the computer. This was really fun, you know. I mean, it was risky in the sense that, you know, you have no time at all go, you know, and it's going to be broadcast extensively. But, you know, there's something wonderful about those kinds of projects that they kind of scare interesting things out of you, I think. And the kind of focus and energy and, you know, the impulses that everybody had to operate on and work on so quickly, I think, you know, created some pretty interesting results. And it was just a lot of fun because it suddenly felt like, oh, I'm back at work, you know?
Yeah.
It was great fun. I loved it. And I don't know. I mean, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, like something new comes out of this that we can do until the operas reopen and maybe even beyond, you know? It was, what was really artistically exciting about this was, you know, having to, I'm a playwright and I also write screenplays. And so to mix, you know, my screenwriting skills with the opera skills, and opera's so expansive and screenwriting and images are so small and economical. And I mean, it just created a really interesting, a different kind of palette that you could paint from, I guess. And I love that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's great.
And Childers has made an animated work, and Deborah wrote a screenplay. John has, you know, filmed it like a film. And one of the special things about this project is that it was truly made for this moment. It's not just, you know, staged to film or you know, a concert or a talk or some of the things that people have done to keep the torch lit.
Sure.
Over the last few months. This piece was made for this moment, and form follows function.
Absolutely. And I think that it has the opportunity to spark, as Deborah was saying, other things that we're starting a new way of looking at opera and viewing opera and hearing opera. And this is the beginning. I think this is a little spark. Gilda, you were going to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I think that part of the dangers of right now are when understandably, we look toward the way things used to be done and we try to do that exact thing now. And it's inevitably going to feel like less than. And exactly as Matt was saying, this was an expansive dive into this time to make something for this moment that doesn't necessarily try to bring forward some other idea of the way we used to do things. There was an invitation to for me, I'm always looking to blow things up, and there's an invitation to do that here. And I was particularly appreciative of at every turn when I had something that maybe didn't conform to the way that it might have, there might have been an expectation that it be done a certain way. I felt like there was an openness to run with it. And I found that necessary and also joyful.
Thank goodness for blowing things up. I think that in these moments when we're all dealing with this sort of collective trauma, to be able to come together and find a way to have a creative outlet that maybe will open some doors to new ways of thinking about art is really, really, really special. So if someone were interested in watching these pieces, how might they do that? They kick off on October 9th, is that correct?
Yes, October 9th is a Friday, and then each subsequent Friday for the rest of the month will be a new episode rolled out. Of course, once you've bought a ticket, those will stay posted for the rest of the year, and you can watch them together or in any order, but they will premiere each Friday beginning October 9th.
Matt and Gilda and Deborah and John, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. I am so excited to see these shows. And I think what you're doing is really, really wonderful.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you're interested in checking out Tales from a Safe Distance, tickets are available at DecameronOperaCoalition.org, and one ticket gives you access to all four episodes. They release on October 9th, 16th, 23rd, and 30th at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and will remain available until December 31st. Thank goodness for all of those people who are forging ahead with creative fire. I look forward to seeing all of this new work premiere. I also want to give a shout-out to Kamala Shankaram, Rob Reese, director Allison Moritz, and the whole cast and crew of Miranda, a virtual steampunk opera produced by Luma, Tri-Cities Opera, Enhance VR, and Opera Omaha. Another amazing group of people moving into uncharted territory together. I watched the production over the weekend and was so proud of the innovation present in the work. Congratulations. Coming up next Monday, I hope you'll tune in when I speak with librettist Jessica Murphy Moo about her operas An American Dream and Earth to Kinsey, as well as what she's been doing during this time of separation and strife. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Keturah Stickhan.